I'm not going to use the laser pointer, I'll use the hockey stick. And it's actually very appropriate. So I'm not from North America, but I landed in North America in 68 in Boston, and my first sport was hockey. So I grew up playing hockey, which is a sort of unexpected sort of thing. But anyway, you know, someone from Tobago. Anyway, I won't talk about that anymore. This talk is a collaboration that grew out of one of my undergraduate students, who's now a grad student at MIT, and this is not a prison mugshot, as Xiao Gang was indicating. Charlie Kane, from a conversation we had 7 years ago, which he had forgotten about, and Brandon Langley and Jimmy Hutsasoy. So the first part was done with Charlie and Kiran, and the last part with Jimmy and Kiran. So the problem I'm interested in is, how does Fermi-liquid theory break down in the cuprates? And the particular point is the Fermi arc structure. So the key observation is that if you shine light on the cuprates, the pole-like excitations don't appear to form a closed surface. They form a surface which is open. Now, there are two different views of this. So the two rather opposing views. One is that there's nothing strange about Fermi arcs, and I'll tell you what is behind this right-wing view. And then there is the other view that Fermi arcs are strange. Now, since this is Canada, to represent these diametrically opposed points of view, it's probably best to use a hockey analogy. So the oldest rivalry in Canadian sports is the Canadians, which were sort of the team I rooted for, and the Maple Leafs. So it turns out that this debate does actually have an answer, and I will try to give you the answer. Okay, so what is behind the right-wing view? So the right-wing view is that, yeah, these are poles, but these are also, it's just that the spectral weight has gone to zero. Okay, so the reason you're not seeing anything here is that it's just a very, very small spectral weight. Okay, now the other view is that there's actually nothing there. But nothing there in a very particular sense. Not nothing there in that the you still have a pole with just zero spectral weight, but there really is nothing there.
Not even a branch point.
Right, right.
I thought the right-wing view was it's not based on reality.
Well, that's actually what I'm going to... Okay.
It's all normal state, though.
Absolutely, the normal state. Okay, so what is the problem for those of us who think that Fermi arcs are strange? The problem is that if you have a pole, the real part of the green function has to change sign on either side of the pole. So what is the problem for if you argue that there's nothing here? So consider a path that goes from here to there and comes back across here. What is the mechanism for changing the sign? That is the problem that we face, namely, how do you come up with a mechanism for getting the correct sign if you don't have a pole? The right-wingers can get around this by saying, yeah, you have zero spectral weight, but there's still a pole there, and hence you can still change the sign. The only solution is that there has to be a zero crossing of the green function. And a zero crossing, I mean by the determinant of G equaling zero, and hence it's the self-energy which is diverging. Okay, so, and the zeros can either be here or they can be on the other side. So if it's here, it'll go from negative, positive, and negative, and hence there'll be no problem in getting the right sign when you come back across. Okay, now this view has been adopted by many people, and in fact, Ziel Leshinsky was really the first one to point out that zeros play an important role in the physics of strong correlations, and they help preserve the Luttinger sum rule. And many people have adopted this, and the question I want to ask is, first, what are zeros? And we know what poles represent. They represent particles, and hence the question I want to focus on are zeros like poles, are poles rather like zeros, a conserved quantity, and hence related to something like the particle density. Okay, so here is how zeros really come about. So zeros come about in the context of the insulating state at in a partially filled band, which cannot be understood unless it costs a certain amount of energy to put two electrons on the same place. And if that is the case, Mott argued that in fact what you see is that the spectral weight splits into two pieces. And it splits into these two pieces without breaking a symmetry. And so you have the same band index here and there. Now, that is very important because if you were to break a symmetry, for example, let me not get to this. So there's no change in this in the size of the Brillouin zone. Okay, so now let's take this gap structure that Mott has proposed, and let's just compute the real part of the Green function. You can do that by just computing this moment. And because this is entirely a positive function, if you integrate this from minus infinity to zero and zero up to infinity, you can change the sign. And hence, you will get a, you could get a cancellation. And in fact, this can be zero. OK, so zeros really are talking about the real part of the Green function vanishing. And for this, this and this have to be in the same band. If you'd broken a symmetry, the Green function would just look like a matrix, one over a resolvent, one over a resolvent. I mean, just a product of resolvents, which can never be equal to zero. So this really is requiring a single band, and it's really the determinant of the real part of the Green function, which is equaling zero. So sort of the definition of Mottness then is this quantity is equal to zero. So and hence, since the spectrum is split between these two places, then you naturally get spectral wave transfer. Okay, so that's what zeros are. And the expression that you can show is related to the particle density under certain conditions is that it's really just related to log g. So it's really related then to the singularities of log g. And the singularities of log g come about any time you have a sign change. So either when this quantity is infinite or that quantity is zero. And hence, the Luttinger sum rule is summing over the locus of points in momentum space where the real part of the Green function becomes positive, which is summing over all poles and zeros. Okay, and this was made very clear in a paper by Ziel Leshinsky, in which he pointed out that to get the Luttinger sum rule in sort of non-traditional contexts, you have to sum over all of the possible sign changes. And if you do that, there should be never a violation of the Luttinger sum rule. It should apply equally in Mott insulators for the reasons which I've indicated, and of course it applies in the case of Fermi liquids. Okay, so the question I want to ask is this famous theorem correct, stated in this form? Okay, this is an answerable question. So let's consider an extreme case of a Mott insulator. Simply, and I've indicated the Hamiltonian right here. I just have a single site, and there's an energy U when I have double occupancy or single occupancy. And I just want to show you that how you can compute the particle density very simply, in this case, using the prescription by Luttinger. So I put the chemical potential in the middle. And and hence this site has, this level has energy minus u over 2. This one has energy u over 2. And the Green function is the sum of this resolvent and that. And if you evaluate this at omega equals 0, this in fact is equal to 0. And the large integer sum rule, n is equal to 2 theta of 0, which is 1 half, that equals 1, which is the correct answer. Okay, so here is an extreme limit in which I have no Fermi surface, but I can get the large integer count correct by simply summing up the zeros of this propagator. Okay, now there's something subtle here. Namely, that if this system's incompressible, I'm sorry, this system is, well, it is incompressible, I can put the chemical potential anywhere between here and there, not just magically at the middle. Now, one of the questions I'm interested in answering is, are zeros a conserved quantity? Okay, now, if they're related to the particle density, it shouldn't matter where I put the chemical potential, but I will change the zero condition. Okay, so let's just look at this function now, evaluated as a function of the chemical potential. And the actual condition now that you have to go and solve to get the particle density is just wherever that thing becomes positive. Okay, so let's plot now what happens to n as I change the value of the chemical potential. Okay, now that something happens is already an indication that there's something wrong. If mu is now here, so it's this thing is positive, this is less than that, this thing is negative, you have zero for the argument, in which case the particle density is zero. And if it's right in the middle, you get one. And if it's below zero, you end up with two. So this is a weird result. It was pointed out in 2007. And so there's no conservation laws when it comes to zeros. And partly it's because there's no physical consequence when a zero crosses the chemical potential. Okay, now one of the questions you can ask is, have I done anything wrong here that's inconsistent with the theorem? So this was the situation in 2007 when I was first working on zeros. And someone said that, in fact, this is the wrong procedure to be consistent with what Luttinger did. What you need to do is take the chemical potential at finite temperature and extrapolate that down to the zero temperature limit, and that will automatically remove this degree of freedom associated with varying where the zeros are. Okay, so what I want to do is use this procedure, and this will fix the chemical potential in the correct place. And so I want to ask the question, does this fix all of the problems? And the answer is no. Okay. So I want to look at I want to devise a model in which I do everything that I'm supposed to do correctly. I put the chemical potential at the place that you would get when you extrapolate from finite temperature down to t equals zero, but you still have a violation of the theorem. Okay, so I just want to look at a system in which I have electrons on a lattice, and to get zeros, I just turn the hopping off. But I have another complication here. I want to have n flavors of electrons in every site. So it's a very simple Hamiltonian. It's entirely a local Hamiltonian in which I have n of these before this term has its full value. Okay, so these colors indicate the different isospin states I have on every site. Okay, now let's just look at the, these are the energy levels for n equals 5. And let's just look at a simpler case, n equals 3. Okay, so n equals 3, here are the energy levels. And if I were to compute now the spectral function, there'd be three peaks corresponding to transitions from here to there, there to here, and here to there. And here are these three peaks. And I want to consider the Mott case. The Mott case can either be partial filling, in which I only have one state, one level occupied, or I have two of them occupied. So if these are occupied, the chemical potential has to lie symmetrically between here and there. Now you see the problem. If somehow the reason why Luttinger's theorem was working in the first place is because you had particle hole symmetry, you've completely broken that here. And that's why we went to this model. And so now, let's just go and evaluate the Luttinger theorem. For this problem, everything can be done exactly. You can go and compute the green function. And the part that can change sign is Very simple. It's just this part right here. This is irrelevant. And what you find is that the theorem now becomes this quantity. It's the number of flavors, the theta function of 2n minus big N. So let's consider a simple case. Let's consider the case of small n equals 2, that case I showed you, and you have three flavors. In this case, you have theta of 1, which is 1. So you end up with, in this case, that 2 is equal to 3, which is clearly not correct. And the problem is that any time this is even and big N is odd, there is no solution to this equation. Okay, so this is an exact demonstration. But you might say, well, this doesn't actually apply to the cases that Luttinger was interested in, because this system is hugely degenerate. Okay, so does the degeneracy really matter? So let me lift the degeneracy by putting on a small value of the hopping. So if I lift the degeneracy with a small value of the hopping, I can understand what is happening in this limit by putting in here the density matrix now for a pure state, because that's what's going to happen when I no longer have this huge degeneracy. Well, if I go and do that, these factors still are at, they're still split by energy U. And I can drag these out here. This is the form of what the green function looks like. And this quantity here just looks like this. It's still, so here's the pure state. You're taking the trace of this. And these indices now are still all allowed. And hence, this is a purely diagonal matrix with just ones along the diagonal. So it's very different than applying a magnetic field and lifting the symmetry, because then only one of the isospin states is involved. If you do that by simply applying the hopping, all of the isospin states are still present. And when you do that, the zeros are still in the wrong place. Okay, so the correct limiting procedure that one needs to take to get this result is omega going to 0 and then t going to 0. Okay, and these two limits do not commute. So there's still a problem. And the general problem is the following. If you engineer zeros by setting the green function equal to 0, not setting the numerator equal to 0, so sigma has to go off to infinity. Now, if sigma goes off to infinity, it means lifetime of the particle vanishes. So which means the width of that state is actually not in the range such that you can actually call this a particle. Okay, so it's certainly sort of strange then that you're including something in the particle count, which is explicitly not a particle. Okay, now in terms of the math of where the theorem went wrong, at least extending it to the case of zeros, it's very clear. If you look at the Luttinger-Ward functional, the quantity that allows you to go and perform this integration is the self-energy. So if the right-hand side of this thing is infinite, you can't go and compute this integral. It doesn't exist. And hence, you can't carry through the procedure to actually make the statement that you should sum over the locus of points where you just have sign changes of the green function. OK, so that means that there was never any such theorem. In the case where it does apply, I claim it's a tautology because it's just poles, and it's governed by a Gaussian theory anyway. Okay, so is there any experimental conservation for experimental confirmation for this violation? Okay, so let's look at what the experimentalists have actually plotted. So what they've done is they see an arc, but they extend this over here. So this is actually assuming then just by measuring KF, you can actually just extrapolate this part that you do see over here, which means that also, although you don't see it, you're just saying there's still a pole, but with vanishing spectral weight. Okay. Or you can simply close it on the other side by assuming there's also a pole, but vanishing spectral weight. So both of these procedures, but this procedure was used for these points right here. Now the uncertainty then in these points is 0.02. So this is the nominal doping level, and this is the x that is inferred now from just looking at the volume of this construction. Okay, so what is being falsified here is the first claim, the right-wing view, that the Luttinger count can be obtained by simply assuming that the pieces which aren't showing up are simply poles with zero spectral weight. And as you see, there's complete disagreement here in terms of, relative to the error bars. So we know then it's not the first scenario. The only way to really get a violation of this theorem is if you have an infinite self-energy. If you have just a vanishing spectral weight, you still have a pole, the theorem still goes through.
Sorry, Philip, if the spectral weight is zero, then there is no pole, really.
No, that's not correct.
Why not?
You have to, it's a ratio of two quantities.
Yeah.
Okay? So for example, in a critical Fermi surface, the key point there is the spectral weight has gone to zero, but you still have a sharp Fermi surface. Okay, which means you still have a pole. Then it's not. You can certainly have. It's certainly allowed for the spectral weight to go to zero, but for you to still have a zero in the denominator. Okay, so what you're arguing for there is that the spectral weight is going to zero faster than the denominator is. If you're arguing for the green function to go to zero, that's what you're arguing for. Okay, and this lack of agreement here has falsified that scenario. Okay, so there's only one option then. So what this is really telling you is that each hole doesn't correspond to a single k state. So there's no single particle picture that underlies this experiment. Okay, so which means now that we can actually settle this debate. I'm sorry, Torontonians, but Montreal wins again. okay. okay, so they are strange, okay? okay, so what this means now is if you see arcs, you really have to take them seriously, which I suspected 10 years ago, which is why I started working on zeros, for the last 10 years. Okay, so it means that that there's some charged stuff that has no particle interpretation. Okay, that's what arcs are really telling you. Okay, so it has no particle interpretation. How do you make any progress? Okay, so here I'm going to... No, there's still a pole there. There's still a pole. Okay, so as long as there's a pole, the theorem goes through.
Okay, so and what are you assuming about the form of the self-energy?
That it vanishes as you go to the chemical potential.
Okay.
So in other words, m sigma is smaller than epsilon p.
Okay, so this is the scenario that you think is consistent with the data.
No, that's inconsistent with the data.
The
M sigma is bigger than epsilon p.
Okay, so I should imagine a kind of a diverging self-energy?
Yes. That's the only way to engineer a zero now. What has been falsified is the first claim that it's really just related to of something in which the spectral weight is vanishing faster than the denominator is going to zero.
In the 1D case, where we know things exactly.
Yes.
Is the self-energy diverging?
Okay, so I would claim in that case you can't even define what you mean by the self-energy. Okay, that's what I would actually claim in that case. But what is interesting though which is where I'm going with all of this. In the 1D case, you still preserve the Luttinger sum rule. Okay, the Luttinger liquid still preserve that. Now, that's partially due to the fact that in the Luttinger green function, in the Luttinger liquid green function, it's actually a ratio of two quantities. Something has an algebraic part and something has a p minus pf. So they're sort of like pseudo Fermi liquids. Plus, there's something else that's going on in that case. There are only 2 points. Okay, so it's not like the 2D case where you're arguing for an anomalous dimension and the whole thing still preserving the volume. Okay, so it's, I think both of those sort of make this case sort of special. Okay?
I guess one more question. I don't know if you'll get to it. Does dynamical mean field theory support the general picture that you're arguing?
Yes, in fact, that's how I got into zeros. Tudor Stanescu, who was on the paper with Gabby that saw the zeros, was visiting Illinois, and I thought this was a very strange result, so I started thinking about where could that come from, because you aren't breaking any symmetry to get these zeros. Okay, so they were first seen by dynamical mean field theory. Okay, and in fact, they had to reparameterize things because the self-energy was diverging. They had to go and use these cumulants, okay, rather than the dynamical mean field theory is based on the self-energy. You clearly can't implement it in the Mott problem because it's infinite. Okay? Okay, so look, we have a situation here in which we understand everything over here, and we have a self-energy which is diverging. The only way that we understand anything in physics is if there are fixed points. So there has to be clearly a new fixed point over here. I'm going to assume that one exists and tell you what I think the consequences of that existence are. So all fixed points have scale invariance. Okay? So let's just now take this seriously. So let's wed strongly correlated matter, electron matter, with scale invariance. Okay? And what you end up with has to be on particles. Okay? Now, many hate this term, like Eduardo. Okay, because actually there's a very nice paper by Ken Wilson, you'll see what I mean by on particles in a minute, in which he has exactly the same propagator that Howard wrote down. Of course, Howard didn't reference him because it wasn't even clear in Howard's paper that he was really talking about a fixed point. That's sort of our contribution to all of this. But it was actually Wilson, okay, and several other people who've done conformal field theory. Okay, so I claim then that this Fermi arc problem really is telling us about some strange stuff that is governed by a new non-trivial IR fixed point. Okay, and the spectral function then has to, you can just write down from just general scaling considerations, and you know, this exponent here will not be -1 as it is in a Fermi liquid. It'll be some strange power law. Okay, now what I want, now there are many ways of understanding these sorts of strange power laws. Let me go through one possible scenario of how you might end up with strange power laws. And this, I think, is really Howard's contribution, because people would not have started rethinking this problem had Howard not written his paper. Okay, so I know there are Howard haters out there. I am not one of them. I think Howard's a great guy. Okay, so let's just consider the simplest field theory you can. It's just a massive free field theory. And let's just undergo this scaling. And these things scale differently, okay? Their powers here are different, hence hence the statement, anytime you have a mass, that breaks scale invariance, because, you know, mass sets a scale. Okay, but let's just redo this problem by introducing now the same equations of motion now, but treating mass as a parameter. And I'm going to define my Lagrangian as an integral over all possible mass. So this is a continuous mass formalism, okay? Okay, exactly, I will come to that, okay? Okay, because I want to show that because of this, you can rewrite the whole problem in ADS, and that fixes what this extra dimension is, okay? I mean, that fixes what the mass is, okay? Okay, so this is the theory with all possible mass. And in fact, it is scale invariant, okay? Because anything you pick up here, you can just redefine your integration variable, and you'll end up with something that is entirely now scale invariant, okay? But the stuff that's described here are not particles. These are unparticles. Okay, so this is a way of thinking about how you can get So the propagator then would be some weight function multiplied by this. This integral will in general give you a power law. Okay? And you can interpret this power du as the scaling dimension of your unparticle field. Okay, now propagators like this have been showing up in our field by explicit constructions. Sung Sik Lee and my former brilliant student Denis Daladovich is now has obtained things that look like this. Also the Stanford group in a fairly different context. But what I'm arguing is that this has to be the result you always end up with.
So you always obtain this at the fixed point of the local field theory. You always obtain.
Okay, so
in the Wilson official fixed point.
Yeah, but okay, now the key thing here is that in those cases, those dimensions are actually tiny. Okay, in this construction, du can really be anything. Okay, so the key point now is that if you're trying to argue for suppression of spectral weight, what you want is a propagator that looks like this, in which du is now a very large number. Okay, and if it can be a large number, maybe we can actually calculate exactly what that number is, which is what I'm going to do next. Okay, so now another insight that Howard had, which may or may not be correct, and I'll tell you why it might be problematic, is that what he did is he said, okay, let's look at the propagator for n massless particles. Well, it looks like this. And the propagator, in the case of for unparticles, it looks like this. So one just has du, the other has n. So perhaps unparticles are just a fractional number of massless particles. Okay? Now, this propagator, will, as I mentioned, will be of the kind that I want to explain zeros if du can be bigger than 2. Okay, so the question now is, what is du? Right now, it's just a parameter in the theory. Okay, so to answer that, Baskerville has already put us on this track. What is the summation over mass? Well, the summation over mass is really an integral over energy. Because mass is energy, okay? Which means what I've done is actually I've actually constructed the theory over all energy scales. Okay, so I've actually run the scaling in, I've actually done the RG sort of calculation, okay? So if that's true, I should be able to implement this with a local picture in space. And in fact, that you all know where I'm going with this. This is the ADS construction. And the key thing here is that all of this is in terms of just conserved quantities, and there's no particle content. And hence, the unparticle construction should naturally be related to a sort of action on ADS. 5 minutes. Excellent. OK, good. Okay, so what has been done? Well, this has certainly been noticed, okay? I mean, Stepanov and Turning pointed out that this action looks an awful lot like the ADS action in which this mass is just this quantity right here, okay? So they didn't make a hard prescription. They said it just looks like it, in which this looks like this, and hence du is still a free parameter. Okay, now what we did is we said, if you really are going to make this analogy, you really have to go and actually prove it, okay? So why don't we just rewrite this integral setting m equal to 1 over a new coordinate? And if you do that, what you find is that this, which is equal to that, this will now just be the bulk 1 over, this will just be the radius of the ADS space. And if you do that, then just rewrite this integral, making all of the substitutions, m is 1 over z, you'll end up with an action that looks like this. And you have z squared here. And z, each z can be paired with one of the x that you're taking, the coordinates you're taking a derivative with respect to. So all of this can be absorbed into the ADS metric. Okay, so this action really is equivalent to that, and g is just this. And so what we then proposed is that this is the generate. You can treat this action on ADS as the generating function for unparticles. Now you have to choose the solutions which decay into the bulk, because I've introduced, by treating the mass as just another coordinate, I have really, I just want the unparticles to live on the boundary, not in the bulk of the system, because I didn't have those dynamics to begin with. Okay, so when I do that, you end up with the unparticle propagator, and you find that the scaling dimension is in fact this. Okay, so if it's that, I look at this then, this is bigger than that, I end up with zeros, exactly what I've been trying to find. So if I make du large enough, I can suppress the spectral weight. Okay, now I claim this has been seen before. Okay, if you look at this paper, it's arguing that in fact the general case in string theory is that if you compute spectral functions for systems at finite density, you don't end up with Fermi surfaces. You end up with things that have these algebraic gaps. Now, the underlying action that was used is this right here. Now, forget about all of the other terms. The important term is this one here. And notice, this coefficient is 1/2. And this is fixed by supersymmetry. Now, this is the relevant term. This is the Pauli term, which was used to explain the anomalous magnetic moment of an electron. If I use this term, and I just introduce a free parameter, if this parameter is coupled to the scaling dimension in the ADS2 region, then in fact, I'm going to have a very particular mechanism of increasing the scaling dimension of my propagator, and I'll engineer a zero. Okay, so that's what we did several years ago. And so P should then suppress the spectral weight. So here are the MIT results, and you see this nice peak right here. And as you crank up P, you can go, this is just plotting the major and the real parts of the dispersion relation. So small p looks like a Fermi liquid. As you crank it up, you can get basically anything you want, a marginal Fermi liquid, a non-Fermi liquid. And this is where the string theory result is, 1/2. And it's bigger than 1 over the square root of 6. Okay, our results are way over here. And in that case, you see the spectral weight has gone to zero. So I would say the correct interpretation of our old results is exactly what I have proposed. Namely, it's just a scenario in which you've increased the anomalous or the scaling dimension of your field. And this field, this parameter P couples to it. OK, so this is work I did with Rob Lee and Mohamed Adelati. And so this matches what you have in the unparticle picture. Okay, now, if I'm arguing then that Fermi arcs are governed by unparticles, this huge anomalous dimension, let's just run a standard ladder instability to try to compute their superconducting properties. And what you find is very much unlike BCS, so if this is the coupling constant between them, their TC increases. So they're inherently unstable to pairing, and this is because scale invariant stuff doesn't like to be scale invariant. It wants to generate a gap. Okay? Okay, now let's look at one more thing. If these really are a fractional number of massless particles, and you consider interchanging them, you should get the phase associated with these du massless particles. Okay, so I'm arguing that you should get a non-trivial phase here, if you could move these things around. Okay, and this phase doesn't equal that, sorry, so it breaks time reversal symmetry. I'm running through because I have a few, just two more slides, I think. Actually, I'm not doing so badly. Okay, so here's sort of the key thing here, okay? So in the pseudo gap phase, you have these broad spectral features, and that's what I call, something has a large anomalous dimension, there's no peak. I would argue that's where the unparticles are. The superconducting transition is something that breaks scale invariance. If it breaks scale invariance, you have to end up with a sharp peak. So I would say that this sort of dichotomy between the broad and sharp features is naturally explained within this scenario. Okay, so I think I just have one more transparency. Okay, so the big summary is that Fermi arcs imply zeros. I've shown that it's reasonable that they are related to unparticles. You'll definitely get a violation of Luttinger's count. And there are several consequences. It's, I think, related to this Pauli gap that we've seen in string constructions. It enhances superconducting instability. The arguments about time reversal symmetry aren't as clear as these two. Okay, so then this leaves a big question, okay? If I'm arguing that there's a fixed point, what is this fixed point? Can I actually go and calculate and show that in the theory, I actually do have this fixed point? It's a very big problem. You're trying to establish a fixed point of a strongly correlated theory. Okay, so here's a possible way in which you might actually think about this. Okay, this is the standard phi to the fourth field theory. Now, what if you scale everything so that this has scaling dimension zero? And when you do that, this kinetic term has scaling dimension, it will be irrelevant. Okay, so one thing that Sung-Sik and I are exploring is trying to make this more rigorous and actually show that unparticles are the excited states of a general ultra-local type of theory. Okay, that's it. Yes.
Right? What happens when I do a shooting of the Haas experiment?
Okay. Excellent question. I don't know. The thing we're trying to do right now is explain this algebraic power law of the optical conductivity. With the unparticle contribution. Okay. So we are beginning to couple these things to gauge fields. It's sort of hard because it's not really a Gaussian type of theory. So we are beginning to do the sort of things that would, in which we can answer that question, but we haven't done that yet.
So a magnetic field may actually introduce a scale like a Landau scale, which will stop the cutoff the growth of the element dimension, but may restore it both.
Right. In which case, as I said, we haven't done it yet. I've told you what we did. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. So we should probably.
No, but are there any other questions or? Yeah.
Do you imply that unparticles will be time reversal symmetric breaking?
This is where I am right now. I mean, there are several steps that have to be filled in along the way, but.
So that's true only if you assume analyticity. If you don't assume analyticity, then a normal dimension doesn't imply braiding or fractional statistics.
Okay.
If you take Wilson's 1974 theory of
quantum
field theory below four dimensions, where he introduces for a theory permanence, there is no braiding. There are no particles.
Right.
There's no more dimension, but there's nothing to break.
Okay.
Maybe one quick question. Yes. So what was your argument for why these unparticles enhance the superconducting instability?
We just redid the ladder instability argument, and we found the TC went up. Okay, so what the explanation for that, as you decrease the coupling constant, is that if you have scale invariant matter, it doesn't like to be scale invariant. I mean, all matter likes to have some sort of scale. So it's unstable. So I'd argue the whole pseudogap region is unstable to anything that is going to open a gap, which is why there's competing order. Okay, so that's why the moment you turn on anything, you just get this huge dynamical response in the system.
Okay.
Thank you.